Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Another day is here and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Welcome to Conversations with the Voice of Reason. I'm your host, Benjamin Boyce, and today's conversant is medical doctor Andrew Givzietz, who has been speaking out about medical malpractice, like systemic, serious level medical malpractice for the last few years, and suffering the social and professional consequences. He spoke out about the medical response, or at least the systemic medical response by the United States and worldwide powerful organizations to the COVID pandemic. And he's also been speaking out about gender-affirming healthcare. He's a wonderful man, a man of faith, a man of truth, and a man who is following through on his ethical convictions. And I'm really proud to have him on the show and I learned a lot from him. And so without further ado, here is Andrew Givzietz. Hello.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. How are you doing, Andrew? Doctor?
Not too bad. No complaints.
You having a fulfilling Tuesday afternoon?
It's the beginning of the week. So, you know, one more day until the middle and then we are into the end.
Yeah. Do you have what kind of practice do you run?
So I do private practice, telehealth. I also teach for the medical boards, USMLE, step one, step two, step three. Those are for the first 2 years, which is didactic coursework, your classroom study. You have to take that step one. That's your first kind of gatekeeper kind of moment. Then the next 2 years are clinicals. And you have to take the step two, which are more focused on diagnostics and what you actually do in the hospital. Then when you either before you go to residency or during your residency, before you complete it, you have to do the step three, which is, you know, now you're an actual physician and that's the way it goes. So it's just stepwise exams that you have to pass to get licensed.
And have these been pretty consistently rigorous, or has there been any change over since you've been teaching these and?
Overseas. I mean, since I've only been teaching since 2019, so not terribly long. Okay. So I don't know that I have, you know, an in-depth look at these things over time, but it changes a little bit by year. I've seen it become, we see some subtle nuances and subtle changes in it. We've actually seen a little bit more biochemical warfare stuff on the exam. We're seeing a lot more transgender stuff on the exam. So some more socially relevant things on the exam, but overall it stays pretty much the basics, right?
Yeah. I mean, there's kind of, in the popular discourse right now, there's a little bit of worry about the airlines going, trying to fulfill some sort of liberal principle of equality in staffing and how that might be affecting, the rigors of, you know, who gets to fly the plane and how the plane is built and stuff like that. I'm wondering if you're seeing that replicated in the medical field.
Well, I mean, I think that's always been a part of the medical system, at least since I even tried to go to med school and things like that. There's always been this like DEI, this DEI thing and affirmative action and those kinds of things that have been in all businesses. It's no different in the medical field. So that there's always quotas to fill. They want certain amount of people of this gender, of this creed, of this race, of this color, you know, you probably name it. They probably have a quota for it. And yeah, we 100% we see it in medicine. Anecdotally, I've seen it a lot in medicine. You see people that are given positions that, you know, they wouldn't have likely gotten based on merit or scores or things like that. We definitely see that.
And is that mostly in the, like, the administrative apparatus, or is it also replicated in the surgeons and medical doctors and nurses and stuff like that? How impactful is that?
I think it goes across the board, because even when I was just applying, you know, for med school, you can get a textbook that tells you every single breakdown of every university, who they took, broken down by age, by race, by score. I mean, they stratify all the data. You know, we live in a data driven society, so you can get your hands on these things. And yeah, you see disproportionate differences across the board for who's getting allowed into schools, who, you know, I think we saw that with Harvard recently. I think that was an eye-opening thing when I think her name was Claudine Gay, you know, who was brought in and had a bunch of plagiarism and so forth. Look, people that don't realize that this has been happening, I mean, they might be shocked to see what goes on in the medical system. It's no different than any other industry.
Yeah. So on balance, then, I ran across you in a space, which is a Twitter like call-in kind of thing, that was hosted by Colin Wright, who's a friend of mine. And it was about evolutionary biologist, but he's like not just like a theoretical biologist. He's spent a lot of time studying, and he left academia because of its fraught relationship with reality. Specifically around the reality of sex, and he just disagrees with this gender stuff. And that was the space that he was hosting. It was in reaction to another space that I wasn't a part of, where another so-called PhD, I think, which is still questionable, they were debating about the gender thing. So we're not only here to talk about your experience with gender, but I think it is tied with, like, I would like an overall view of your position on where medicine is going. Why, if this gender or childhood transition trend, if it is a trend, is connected with other so-called social justice kind of movements, if you see it as just kind of the next evolution, maybe of, or somehow tied to advancement in the field.
Well, you know, I think there's just so many angles to look at it. I mean, obviously, just on the nose, it's idealistic, right? This is an ideology. This isn't anything that's fundamentally rooted in any biological principle. I mean, you know, it sounds oversimplification, but let's be honest. We all know what a man is. We all know what a woman is. We all know what the difference between male and female. You know, a lot of the terminology has been twisted. You can look back as early as, you know, the 60s and look at Dr. John Money. I'm not sure if you're familiar with him, but, you know, if you look at John Money, they started separating out, you know, gender versus sex, when before that, these two things were kind of used interchangeably. Whereas they're saying, okay, so sex is your biological makeup, your genotypic makeup, and gender is your social construct. And that works in a society, right? You know, people men can be more effeminate, you know, females can be more masculine based on the cultural, you know, gender roles and so forth and so on. But when it comes into what they're talking about in transgender medicine, it's purely delusional, like that males can become females truly biologically, that men can get pregnant. The fact that we have medical professionals that can't define what a female is or what a male is. I mean, you see that it's become quite a social contagion, and it's definitely a fad, right? We learn about this in med school, you know, the transgenderism, which typically, from a textbook kind of perspective, would be somebody whose psychological makeup doesn't or isn't congruent with their biological makeup, right? That's what transgenderism is. And historically, it affected, I think, 0.01% of the population at large. That population was actually majority young girls. I think, you know, 5 to 9 years old, that, like, you know, are going through a time in their life where maybe they're bigger and a little bit stronger than boys, and they want to play more masculine roles and on the playground and stuff like that. And they, you know, that's where this kind of stemmed from historically. Now we're seeing it across the board. There's been like a, I want to say like a last I read like a 4,000% increase in a certain age group for people identifying as transgender. I've had a lot of discussions with a lot of detransitioners in over the last couple of years, and a lot of the LGBT community that's kind of off the chain, like off the rocker, is in terms of what they believe, and they can't even get any of their beliefs straight. Right. They, I mean, they're all infighting about what they believe as well. I've heard some crazy things about hormone washes in the brain and how transgender can be something that's identified at birth. Harvard actually has a course in their curriculum that discusses this kind of gender ideology in infants. It's insane. Right.
In your medical training, did they not, or did they teach you about medical fads and the the outcomes of these different fads, or was that kept on the DL? Because medicine is possessed by ideologies, theories.
Sure. And they definitely leave things like that out, right? You know, they're not going to teach you about the fads of bulimia or anorexia, you know, in medicine, but they train you what it is and how to treat it. And obviously you wouldn't, you wouldn't treat any of these things in a similar fashion as transgenderism. Now, I went through medical training a little while ago, so I'm not up to speed with exactly what they're training them to do now in so far as what the classroom looks like. But just 6 years ago, the classroom didn't look like that. You know, transgenderism was, you know, it's a mental illness in the DSM-5. It should be treated like a mental illness. We were trained that, if an adult wanted to transition, they'd have to go through like 10 years of therapy, and then they'd have to socially transition. And then possibly if they get a psych eval, they could maybe go and get a surgery or things like that. And, you know, it was such a fringe thing that you don't really study it in detail in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah.
So I was actually not even aware that this was anything of importance, even within our society, until just a couple of years ago. And I've been in medicine for not outrageously long time, but long enough where, I mean, they kept all this stuff under wraps.
And how did you stumble on it?
There were a lot of activist doctors that I worked with, they were wearing their rainbow pins, and I never paid too much attention to the movement. I wasn't that socially aware, I guess, of what was going on. I was paying attention to medicine and my studies and so forth and so on. But I always thought it was just like more of a social thing where people wanted to use their pronouns. And I thought that was foolish. And in medicine, it's dangerous, right? If a woman comes into the ED and claims to be a man and they look like a man and they write that they're a man, and you wind up getting an X-ray or a CT or giving them aspirin and they're pregnant, there's so many problems. Not diagnostically, I'm looking for completely different diseases in men than women. So not to jump into that, but you see this kind of activism, and I started getting it, an understanding that these people were really, really radical and had a really radical view on things. And I actually stumbled across Chloe Cole's story, and that was the very first story of anything I ever saw happening in a child. And I was just appalled at her story. She got, I think, puberty blockers at 12, double mastectomy at 15. And then I fell down a rabbit hole and I started looking this up, and I was really just shocked. And I brought it to my leadership and to doctors and colleagues, and their response was, she's an activist. She deserved what she got, and she's a hateful bigot. And so are you.
Oh.
And then the onslaught after that just never ended.
What concerns were you trying to address by bringing this to your leadership? Very simple question, but like, what is the core of your reaction to seeing that?
I mean, first and foremost, this is a child that was allowed to, be put on drugs and hormones to, to change her whole entire identity based on a psychological illness. There's so many things to dig into here that are problematic. Yeah. Number one, you never treat mental illness with surgery. that the last time that that happened was the transorbital lobotomy. Quite literally the last time that the medical system ever, and they thought that was a great idea. And we look back and we think how barbaric, what was going on in their mind? And we're seeing a very similar picture, only worse. So, I mean, that's one of the things. The other issue is this. Puberty is a natural process. Who halts somebody's puberty? The same exact thing that you give to, you know, to block puberty or to chemically castrate a child is the same thing that you would give to a sex offender to castrate them. Like castrating a child is so insane to me that I didn't even know where to begin with saying how fundamentally flawed all of this thinking is. You know, a child can't choose their bedtime. They can't choose what to eat. They're not allowed to make their decisions because they haven't grown yet. The brain isn't neurologically developed well until about 25 years of age. And even if a 25-year-old said I wanted to remove my genitals, we would consider that a deep mental illness and we would look at every other approach possible. And even from a medical perspective, I would never encourage even an adult to do that. Because it's not rooted in reality. A delusion is a fixed false belief that is present for more than 30 days at a time. That is the definition of a delusion. If you believe you're the opposite gender when you're obviously not the opposite gender, that's a delusion, right? And it's a social fad that's happening in our children because they realize that if they're lonely or sad or going through tough times, which is what the teenage years really are, they realize that they can join a part of a community, have a vast network of people that support them, that will fight to the death for them if they stay within the confines and do as they're told and so forth. I mean, so it's a safety net for kids. And like I said, it's so dangerous. I mean, it's such a dangerous ideology.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Pardon me. As a sub note, if I had a fixed false belief for only 27 days, what would that be?
So it's not considered, it wouldn't be considered a delusion by the medical definition.
If it passes, it was just like a brain flight or something like that. Is there, I'm just curious about that. Okay.
I'm actually not sure.
Okay.
I'm not sure.
Don't want to derail the conversation, but
you're perfectly fine.
The 30 days. Like that's the mark. That's the line that's drawn in the sand.
Well, so there always has to be some line, right? In these things, like if you're diagnosed with major depression, it has to be 14 days at least.
Okay.
We discuss this in medicine. Oh, what if it's 13 days?
Yeah.
For the book to actually draw a line, they have to draw a line somewhere. So I suppose that, you know, they give it enough time to say, hey, here, this is enough time to where you probably should have thought about this and considered it further.
Yeah.
Something like that.
So if you could hazard a guess about the reaction that you received when you tried to raise awareness or concerns about this medical practice and your leadership, you said your leadership denounced you quite strongly. Why would they have that reaction to a fixed false delusion? Why would they support a delusion? What's going on in their framework that this is something that is really amenable to them to be fixed?
I've really thought about this. I've really heavily thought about this, and there's a couple things that come to mind. That, you know, there's the obvious monetary incentive. Let's be completely honest, within the medical system, if you have a child that's trans at the age of five, they're going to require psychology, psychiatry, close primary care follow-up, pharmacology, surgery. Then there needs to be new education put in place, new laws, new litigation, new lawyers, new clinics, new counselors, new nurses, the amount of things that this touches is so broad and so fast.
And plus you get brownie points if your hospital supports this stuff. You're seen as cutting edge. It's a status boost.
Yeah. And so that's so there's a monetary benefit. There's the social credit that you just discussed. You know, so people that want to be on the right side of history and be on the social justice movement. And what I really see is people perpetuating evil to look good.
Mm. What I guess human beings are flawed, but like, can the some people have called this this particular eugenics project around you know, transitioning children, castrating children, as the biggest medical scandal of the century. There's also, you know, one might suppose that a certain novel coronavirus that spread around, and the response to that was another. There's some iffy things over there too, but in your experience or from your perspective, how does one change the medical system when it starts to huff some sort of like toxic fumes of its own, you know, devising?
This is a challenging question. We've put together a coalition of doctors who are, standing against this. Many of us speak out very, very loudly against this. In the very beginning, people didn't even believe that this was happening, which should kind of pay homage to the fact that how bad it really is. People didn't even believe that this was possible. People didn't even believe that this could happen. And it's still, people still do believe it. You bring up these lawsuits, these cases, these individuals, and people still say, that's not happening. That's not true. And then when they find out it is true, they're like, well, this must have been an extremely rare case. A child cannot strong arm a physician into cutting off their genitals under threat of suicide. Because that's the whole big thing that happens, right? Mm. You know, these children are being groomed to go to the hospital and say, if you don't do this, I'm going to kill myself. And that, you know, that makes obviously no sense. If somebody threatens to kill themselves or kill others, which is called, suicidal or homicidal ideation, you have the right to hold them right at the hospital and monitor them 24/7 to make sure that that doesn't happen. The idea is that a child can strong arm a physician into getting all of this treatment is, you know, when did the children become the leaders and the dictators of what a doctor is going to do with their training? Yeah. That obviously goes against all logic, but I don't know how, I don't necessarily know how we approach this other than speaking out, showing it for what it is, and speaking quite honestly and truthfully about it. And the truth is that a doctor is convincing a child that they're born in the wrong body, putting that child on the same exact drugs that you would put a sex offender on, and then wheeling that child into a fluorescent lit operating theater and cutting off their breasts or testicles. Mm-hmm. That's actually happening right now. And I think people need to realize and think about it, that that's what's actually happening here. Mm-hmm. And once again, we've seen this kind of stuff happen in the medical system before. We saw the lobotomy. We've seen the medical system do things like the Stanford Prison Experiment. We've seen the Tuskegee syphilis experiments. We've seen doctors like Joseph Mengele. We've seen this stuff in history, so we're seeing it happen right now. And you said something that I think is worth restating. This is the most scandalous and evil thing that has ever been perpetrated by the medical system ever. And you touched on COVID, and I have a lot of thoughts on COVID, and I work with a lot of excellent doctors, surrounding what happened with COVID. But even if you consider the worst case scenario of COVID, if it was some genocidal lunacy, which I believe it was, that was killing populations. This is children, and it's not injecting them. It is mutilating them and carving them up and removing their ability to procreate. There's something on a whole nother level. That I think about this, which is why I've focused more of my time into fighting this than COVID. Particular.
One sub note, I have a bigger question, but just one question. I just want to press against something you said, because I hear this a lot. I just want clarification on it. The Lupron is used for not just castrating sex offenders, but also to help, I believe, to help men with prostate cancer too. I don't know if it's a strong argument to say that one medication has multiple uses, because needlessly contentious. It's just that particular thing.
I get where you're coming from. Actually, a lot of people talk about things like that, right? If you can use it for, for those kind of issues, I believe they actually use it in precocious puberty as well. If somebody starts going through puberty at like 5 or 6 years old, and you want to slow that process down or something like that, the dosages are different, and it's the intent.
Okay.
Right? It's the intent and the reasoning behind it. So for something with precocious puberty, you're trying to just slow down the process a little bit so that they develop at the age of their peers, and there's some health side effects and health benefits and so forth and so on. For children, you're specifically using it to stop puberty and to change their sex. Right? There's this pervasive intent behind it that definitely makes it very, very different. And the dosage regimens are different, so forth and so on. And there's, at the end of the day, there's tons of problems with this stuff. There's bone loss, there's muscle density loss, there's the
IQ loss.
There's the changes in the neural circuitry. These natural processes, when you mess with them, it can be a little bit dangerous, and there's definitely risks involved.
I guess that kind of like gives more light to the kind of a deeper question that I wanted to venture into with you. On your Twitter bio, it says Christian twice. Yes. You have a picture, and then in your bio it says Christian. So you're not unfamiliar with the concept of evil, or evil as a term to understand a certain phenomena. What are your thoughts on, if puberty is a natural process, why is it evil to halt that? Or why is it evil to meddle with that if we can do it properly? Let's just imagine a transgender, one diagnostic criteria that is actually accurate. There's this thing called true trans. You can diagnose it. And then there is a very low degree of mistakes when prescribing medication and then altering the body surgically. Would that still be considered evil for you? Would it still be considered wrong for human beings to just change nature because they see something wrong with nature?
I think that's a challenging question. And obviously as a physician, there are certain things I have to separate out, right? I don't go wandering around and waving a Bible in people's faces, or there are things like that as a doctor. You have to, there are certain things that just are not appropriate, in a professional setting, I suppose. And, I think at the basic level, would I say it's evil just to halt puberty? Would I say that's no? I don't think that I would go there. But I would question the reasonings biologically behind why you would want to do that, and what is the purpose behind doing it. And I think there is where we might get into a little bit of weeds. If you want to halt puberty, and the reason is that you don't want to be what you are, then that's a challenging reason to not do it, right? Let's say you want to halt puberty because you're an adolescent male and you don't want to become a man. So you're going to halt puberty with the intent to become a female, or stay what you are, or never grow up. Like what would be the meaningful intent behind why you want to do this? And this is where psychology is falling flat on its face without asking any of the deeper questions to actually get at the root behind this. Puberty is a rough time for a lot of kids, right? It's a challenging time. Kids are mean. People's bodies are changing. Hormones are going crazy. Puberty, it seems like this is discussed more and more, and our sexualities are discussed on a public platform, which is something that's very odd in this day and age as well. A little bit of depravity in our society has sunk to very high levels. But again, you would have to look at why somebody's doing this in the first place. And if the idea is to eventually alter yourself in such a way that you are still physically, or I mean still biologically, what you always were, but you're no longer physically, you know, what you were. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
Yeah. Well, because I ask that because there's a lot of really deep philosophical questions, and transgenderism is, I think, one of the first broad scale movements into transhumanism. I see it as the gateway to transhumanism, with us merging with our technology more and more, and us being able to use our will and our intellect, reasoning aside, to do whatever we want with our bodies. And this is a broad scale experiment on an entire generation. So I'm just wondering if medical technology is constantly, it's progressing in the ability for human beings to do what they would with their bodies, with their natural environment, what keeps it on the rails for you? And where's the medical ethical questions that keep us centered on what it's proper to do? Just because you can doesn't mean you should, kind of question.
Yeah. And I think I didn't realize that that's what you were alluding to, but I mean, I think you're absolutely right. This is a major step into, I wouldn't say the first step. We've already crossed over a lot of the first steps of transhumanism. Transhumanism has, people kind of look at it like it's some conspiratorial thing. I mean, it's not. This is stuff that, bionics, bionic medicine, tech, all, this stuff has been, integrated into medicine for a very long time. I mean, you read it as far back as the 70s about bionic medicine and stuff like that. So the first steps happened a long time ago, but this is a major step. You're absolutely right. This is an absolutely major step in that direction. And I as a person of faith, I think that is one of the most grounding aspects of it. Just because we can does not mean we should. Nature is nature. And if you look historically at science, a lot of times, I would venture to say all times, that we synthetically manipulate nature, it blows up in our face, right? We've seen what's happening. We've seen what's happened to our food. We've seen what's happened to cancer rates. We've seen, whenever we meddle and create synthetic biology, it almost always blows up in our face because we're not meant to create that kind of stuff. And, the people who don't have any root in faith, regardless of what that faith is, when they don't have that compass guiding them, I think it's easy to fall into, transhumanism and chipping your brain and so forth and so on, because there's nothing, there's nothing saying that you shouldn't do that. As you said, medical ethics, just because you can doesn't mean you should. And you do have to focus on ethics. A lot of biological ethics go right out the window when you're not rooted in any kind of moral framework.
So how do you scale up your moral framework if your medical profession is failing to act ethically? Is that not one of the points that you need to get across, or something that you need to reformulate or at least call into account? Like, what is our moral framework? Why are we here? What is this industry up to? And I guess it's always going to be a wrestling between the good and the bad, because and it's not just this one issue. It's just, you think about pharma, you think about medicine's relationship to these huge businesses, and how the businesses find weak spots and then get a bunch of people hooked on their medicine for, because it's, they could. And so I'm wondering, is there, accountability aside, scaring them straight, like, what is the moral argument, and why are people countering your argument with it seems like disgust or opprobrium, because you're being a bigot in some way?
Right. Well, I mean, I think first and foremost, there's a lot of changes that need to happen in medicine, and I personally think that the medical system as we know it is crumbling. I think that we're going to see a paradigm shift in medicine. People aren't trusting their doctors after what happened with COVID, after what happened with transgenderism. What's going on right now, people don't trust medicine. And as we see it, medicine is a business. right? As you said, it's under the thumb of big pharma. I think we need to focus a lot more on medical ethics, because that's not something that's focused on, specifically in the training of young physicians. You know, there's maybe a 6-week course where you learn about medical ethics, and it kind of accounts for very little of your grade, but that's a very large part. I think it's the most important aspect of medicine that you're ever going to study is your ethics, justice, non-maleficence, beneficence, autonomy. These are the fundamental pillars of medicine. Okay. You know,
you could probably say that people spend more time in DEI training than in actual ethics, like foundational ethics, philosophical ethics.
I don't think there's any DEI training specifically in med school, if I'm not mistaken. I don't think there is. You could probably take coursework in it, but I don't think it's part of the curriculum. But it's definitely the fact that that's the culture, right? And then when you get into administrative, that's absolutely the training. But I think it needs to be a lot more focused on medical ethics, but a lot more focused on not having pharma's hands in the pockets of the med school, because at the end of the day, pharma's ruining the medical system as we know it as well. People don't, and especially a lot of allopathic physicians, don't want to admit to these kinds of things. But you know, let's take something as simple as psych meds, right? Psych meds have an outrageous amount of, adverse side effects, increased suicidality, black box warnings, reduced libido, infertility. There's so many things that come along with these things, not to mention the monoamine hypothesis has been debunked thoroughly. You know, nobody measures any of your serotonin levels or dopamine levels when you get diagnosed with depression. They just put you on a pill and they can switch you over to a different one if these side effects don't match, or this one. And I have personal experience and a lot of clinical experience with this as well. And, putting everybody on a psych drug instead of focusing on therapy, focusing on what are the issues? Why do you feel this way? Why are you depressed? You know, focusing on their dietary issues. Are you getting all your vitamins, all of your minerals? Are you getting a good diet? How is your GI health? Are you getting proper sleep? Do you have good sleep hygiene? You know, are you stressed out? What are your cortisol levels? What's your thyroid doing? These are things that are much more appropriate to investigate for depression, anxiety, things like that. For anxiety, they want to give, benzodiazepines and things of that nature, which is just alcohol in a pill, works on the same receptor, the GABA receptor, has the same intoxication, same withdrawal profile as alcohol. So really all you're doing is feeding somebody booze. What's the end result of a panic attack? Resolution. It'll resolve. And if somebody can fight through it, there's plenty of ways to help somebody fight through it. You could do pressure on the eyes, which will activate the vagus nerve, cold water shock on the face, which will activate the vagus nerve, calm the heart down, reduce the heart rate, reduce the anxiety. You could do box breathing, which is what the Navy SEALs do to calm anxiety in the field. You know, there's so many methodologies to combat these things, but pharma. And, I know those are psych, but we can go to something as simple as statins as well. Aldosterone, what controls your blood pressure, your sodium, your potassium? Well, you need cholesterol for that pathway. Cortisol, your stress hormone, the hormone that helps you wake up, the hormone that mitigates your stress, your sugar levels, your blood pressure as well. That needs cholesterol. Your sex hormones, testosterone, estrogen, DHT, all this, cholesterol. Why would you take a medication that reduces your cholesterol, that stops you from reducing cholesterol, when you could have diet, exercise, cure your hypercholesterolemia, cure your triglycerides, cure your hypertension? It's almost like everything is just such a quick fix that, and these are the most common drugs, known to man. We need to look at the medical system in a whole different way.
In a way, what you're making me think of, and this is just me shooting it, just popping off here. But there's anxiety. Well, we have a pill for it. There's cholesterol, but it does all these other things, but we have a pill for it. There's puberty. We have a pill for that too. And what's similar in all these things, where we're going to try to intervene with your discomfort. And here's what we have to offer. So it could be the case that a part of the gender industrial complex on the medical level is just because it's just the way that medicine has worked. Sure. It's just how it works. And the all these regulations and all these clinics and stuff and the money, it all flows in the direction that there's these basic assumptions that somehow the, you know, do no harm has been interpreted as we are going to decrease anything that's discomfort, I guess.
Anything that's distress, it's, right?
We're going to see distress as harm. And so we are going to intervene on behalf of you.
Yeah, absolutely. That's, I mean, I couldn't have said it better. That's perfect. Yeah, because that, I mean, that's the way it is. It's symptomatic treatment. It's not treatment of the illness. almost like we're, it's just weakening people instead of facing anything that's going on in life. We've got a pill for it.
Yeah.
Right. It's hard to work. It's hard to work out. It's hard to go run every day. It's hard to eat a healthy diet. It's expensive to eat a healthy diet as well. Mm-hmm. You know, these are all challenging things. So we've got a pill for you.
Yeah. So on one level, what you're working against is laziness, entropy, basically.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, that's where ethics or that's where virtues probably come in.
I'd say working against apathy. Right.
Yeah.
I don't think, you know, people, I don't necessarily think that because people aren't naturally lazy. I mean, that's not really a thing. We can get lazy. All of us have lazy moments, but I think it's more apathy. We've become a fat, apathetic society. And I don't mean fat as in obesity. We are an obese society, but I mean, kind of in the philosophical sense, we're this like fat, apathetic, you know, society that just doesn't care about anything. And you know, relative to the rest of the world, we do live in such a rich nation. We have everything at our fingertips. So, I mean, it's not shocking that, you know, an empire like ours has come to this concluding scene. You know, anybody that is a student of history can trace this back to Rome and before it, or Persia, or any of the other empires. And when you see this kind of, when you see what's going on in our society, the moral decay, the social decline, the depravity, the sexual promiscuity, the drug abuse, all of these things, you know, coincide with when societies collapse.
Yeah. So, I mean, the illness that is being perpetuated by the medical system is itself a symptom of a sick society and the gender industrial conflicts. That's how I think it's kind of tied to something deeper. So you mentioned that you have a coalition of doctors that are speaking out. What is that? And have you seen, or you and your colleagues, have you seen some kind of change in the attitude towards this? Do you think that things are about to change, or?
It's difficult to say. You know, I've been speaking out against this for quite some time. You know, I was heavily censored. I was banned off every social media platform. I was isolated away from everything. I mean, it's been really intense. Thousands of death threats, activists showing up at my work, at my doorstep, you know, phone calls, emails.
What did you say? And to who?
What I'm saying right now, nothing to the tune in. People are very, very tribal when it comes to what's going on right now. And people are really lost in what's happening. And as you said, it is not healthy to be well-adjusted to a sick society. And that's what we're seeing. All of these people are extremely well-adjusted to a sick society. This looks right. All of this looks right.
Okay.
It looks correct. It looks like we're going in the right direction. And, you know, anybody with eyes to see and ears to hear can see the writing on the wall that this is the absolute wrong direction. We are falling down a cliff. I've been outrageously censored, and I'm one of the doctors that stood up against COVID mandates, which was, so I caught it with both barrels, right? COVID happened. I started looking into the research about COVID and the plasmid expression system, the zoonotic infections, the viral enhancement studies, the directed evolution. So I blew the whistle on COVID early too. And all of my same colleagues were, you know, you're wearing a tinfoil hat and you're crazy and you're this and you're that, which is rather interesting because I have a significant research background. I worked in biochemistry labs. I did thermodynamics, lipidomics, protein biochemistry. I did brain mapping at USC. I have a very significant research background in a lot of the things that surround COVID. So, you know, I brought up papers, I brought up research, I brought up the DOD patents. People didn't want to listen. And I caught everything from both barrels. So I think I was one of the more censored physicians in the country for about a year and a half. They really didn't want me saying anything. It was to the point where, you know, I went on and created a new account on Instagram, and my account was suspended the second I hit create.
Yeah, yeah. You should. There should be a plaque, an extra plaque for being so heavily censored behind you on the wall there.
Most censored doctor, right? it's just been really challenging to get the word out. So to answer your question, I don't know. The tides are shifting. They are completely turning. But the gears of these things work slow, and I've learned that over the last couple of years that these things do slowly work. It's almost like the gears of government. You cannot expect them to, you know, we all know what the solution would be. Just say no. We're not doing this. Every single person in the United States, I'm not getting a shot. I'm not wearing a mask. And we don't support gender affirming care for kids. So no, this would be over tomorrow if we could get everybody on that page. But we all know that that's not how it happens. Yeah. So I do think the tides are shifting. I do think more people are listening. We're still in that information stage, right? We're disseminating the information, getting all of that out there. Is the most important thing. And then, you know, corrective action can only be taken when you have enough people that are knowledgeable and willing to take corrective action. So as more people are waking up, more Congress people are waking up to the shots. You know, if you've been following Mary Talley Bowden, she's a colleague of mine, and I've reached out to her, and we've had some chats. Several of my other colleagues, I had the opportunity to sit on a panel with an interview with Macus some time back and so forth and so on. So people are waking up in all the different spheres. They're getting Congress people to listen. Their research is getting listened to. I think McCullough's research that he just published was trending the other day. So a lot of people are working on a lot of different fronts, and things are getting to light. But I think it's going to be a slow progression, because we're also fighting on so many different fronts. But they all tend to be surrounded about medicine as well, which is not shocking, because the medical military industrial complex is their fingers in everything.
It's I know that they have a lot of power, and I think it's probably the ad budget, because YouTube doesn't like me even touching the stuff you said about the blood and how certain things might have been designed in certain ways to do certain things that they are advertised
to do
the opposite.
If you have to edit out, you know, go for it.
I'll mute you and say sciencey words that YouTube doesn't want to be heard, which is just odd why information is being controlled about that particular intervention. Pardon me, what?
But it's not odd, right? It's par for the course.
Yeah. What did you learn about yourself, like speaking about like mental health and stuff, being treated that way, being censored and maligned? What did you learn about yourself, or was that shocking to you? And did you, was it a growth experience for you?
It has absolutely been a really difficult time at times. But, you know, I do believe that we are placed. I don't believe anything is by chance. I believe that we are put in positions, to grow and to learn, and that, you know, the good Lord only ever put me in any position so I could become better and stronger. So, I tried to focus on that as much as I possibly could. It does get to you, because, you know, when everybody's following you and everybody's screaming at you, and if you fight back or say anything back, God forbid, man, they will use your words against you, use your actions against you. No matter what happens, they will come and try to tear you down, every little aspect of your life. So it's been challenging. And it's been a growing experience. But you come out the other end stronger. No matter what, if it doesn't kill you, it only makes you stronger. Those words, all of these old sayings that we kind of throw around colloquially, as if we're, philosophical, these old basic sayings are the most critical and the most fundamental And they've been around forever, not because we think they're, quirky or fun, but because they exist and they're real. You know, if it doesn't kill you, it makes you stronger. You know, the truth will always prevail. You know, these very simple things, that I try to live my life by, you know, have really helped me through. And without that, it's another thing. It's just deepened my faith. You know, I can say with 100% certainty, there's no way I would have gotten through these last several years if it wasn't for Jesus and if it wasn't for God. Because when you're seeing the writing on the wall years ago, when nobody is saying anything, right? And there were so few of us. I mean, there was a handful. I think across the entire United States, there was a handful, and none of us knew each other. So we were very isolated. We're seeing all this happening. We're trying to speak out. Every single person's against you. It, you know, it makes you question your sanity.
Yeah.
You know, not anymore, but back, 3 years ago, stuff like that. It was definitely interesting. I will say that.
Yeah, it kind of goes back to what you're saying about like that fixed false belief that lasts for 30 days. Like, you have to kind of have faith, like, no, I think I'm righter than everybody around me, but everybody's really believing this thing that it's not true, though. So you have to figure that out. Yeah. And then reach out, finally find people that can see things the way you do.
Thankfully, there were enough things that were just outright ridiculous, right? Like wearing the masks, the masking mandates. That was, perhaps not for somebody who's not in the scientific field, but for somebody who's been in research labs and surgery ORs and things like that, you know, when they're like mask up and you're like, especially in pediatrics, you know, you look at the masking in peds and you say, hey, they're not going to be able to breathe and their oxygen sats are probably going to go down a little bit. And the mucociliary escalator system isn't going to work as well. You're circumventing their own natural immune system. You're creating a petri dish on a little dirty kid's face that they're going to take off and get dirty and put back on. You're trapping bacteria on the inside of the mask. Pneumonia is going to go up. Viral infections are going to go up. These kids that are not able to hear when they're developing, they got muffled speech from everybody. They can't hear well. Their hearing development's going to decrease. They're not neurocognitively, there yet. So they're learning emotions and they're learning what they see and they're learning reactions. Well, if you mask somebody's face, they're not going to see any of that. So, which is why we saw so much decline. You isolate them from other people, you're going to see, depression, anxiety, all of these things are going to start to get changed because you're altering the natural progression of their social programming or their natural social progression. So there were so many things that were just ludicrous about what they were doing that made me, not feel so crazy about standing up against the other things as well. Because in the beginning saying, oh, this is a bioweapon. People are like, listen, you are really off a cliff. Like, no, I don't think so.
There was this article that came out in the esteemed Atlantic Monthly that said, everybody made mistakes. We should let bygones be bygones. But it was the people, the people who were pro mask mandates, pro vaccine mandates, and then if you look at how that has impacted an entire generation, like this is a major amount of harm, socially, developmentally, educationally, and then physically too, with all you were saying about the masks. And they were the ones who want bygones to be, mistakes were made, were the ones who were virulently or like viciously attacking anybody who was standing against them. Vicious.
Yeah. I think it's, we saw a very dark side of humanity. I mean, we really saw. I mean, not wanting people to be able to get groceries unless they show a vaccine card. Wanting people's businesses to be just buried. Wanting people not to be able to feed their family. The mainstream media going round and round lying about basic medical facts that any doctor could be like, that's not true. And then saying like, screw your freedom and you guys are killing people. Everything about it was just the vitriol and hate was just so, so profound. And And yeah, it echoes Germany. I mean, it really, really just echoes. You know, I think everybody grew up wondering that age-old question, like, what if you'd have lived in this time? Would you have stood up? I think we saw that. We saw who would stand up, and we saw who would be on the other side of social contagion and allow their tribalism to take over their heart and soul. We saw a very dark side of human nature, and no. There, it isn't bygones be bygones. I mean, I'm not saying that there needs to be some vicious retribution, or that there just need we just need to wipe out the, you know, every single person who wasn't, you know, awake. No, not at all. But the people who are in charge of perpetrating these things, yeah, they need to be brought and held accountable. The people who were vicious and vitriolic, yes, they need to be brought to justice. You know, these are the sick individuals in our society. These are the people that don't belong in our society, because
Let alone controlling it.
let alone controlling it. So, you know, I get a lot of flack because, you know, I am a proponent of, you know, quote unquote, Nuremberg 2.0. You know, hold every yes. When there's a mass genocide, when you are against your neighbor at this fundamental of a level, yeah, you need to be held accountable.
Okay.
Every single person needs to be held accountable for this.
Yeah. Do you think that that is going to pan out, or do you think that it'll just kind of wash, go get away in the wash?
I think it'll fizzle. You know, I think there will. You look, it's, you know, and I'm speaking from a just from a historical perspective, right? You know, there will be, I really do believe that there will be some very public people that go down. There will be some very people in high places, enough people to, you know, to satiate the masses, right? The people in the Colosseum need to see enough blood, right? And that's what we're going to see, I think, is enough to satiate the masses. But I do think, I truly do think that this is a defining and an altering moment in the trajectory of the United States of America and the globe. We've never seen anything like this happen before. There hasn't been enough interconnectivity, the internet, you know, understanding and being able to see what's going on in all parts of the globe. We've never seen something perpetrated across the entire earth. So and people are awake more than ever. Right, they realize that they've been living in slavery, that there's so many open air prisons here, and that people are really waking up. So I think that it's just the cards were overplayed so significantly at this point that I think we're going to see. I don't know what the changes will all be, but I have a very distinct feeling that we are in for, I mean, outrageous societal changes.
Yeah, well, I mean, you look at what the WHO is trying to do, the World Health Organization, and I know that they kind of are retracting some of the gender stuff. They're about to try to export like our wonderful gender ideology across the world, but you also see them starting to meddle with local and state laws and who can how they can like shut down agency, the agency of individual peoples, or at least override them in case of an emergency. It's very fascist. It's just medical fascism at this point. It's they get to decide what the exception is, but we know that they were wrong on so many different places, and we had to play along. But we'll see what
Well, so
happens.
hopefully we'll just set up a, you know, a completely parallel medical system. You
Yeah.
know, I think a lot of people want more natural remedies. A lot of people want to be explained why their health is the way that it is, how their body's working, what they need to do to get better. I think a lot of people are ready to take more charge of their
Okay.
health, and they're
Yeah.
willing to be more in charge of it with their doctor.
Okay. Yeah.
So I actually think that, you know, in terms of that,
Okay.
I think that that's going very, very well.
But I think that's a really important point, because the system is catering to the society. If the society, if the individual takes back agency from from the pill producers, say, no, okay, well, that's the easy path, but that's not the good path. I'm going to be responsible for myself. And then that's the sea change. It's more individual responsibility. And then I believe that the medical system will either adapt to that, or an alternative medical system will rise up to support that.
Yeah, and you know, the question will be is how, you know, how deep does the rot go? I guess, in the medical establishment. I mean, sure. I personally think that we are going to see the crumble of allopathic medicine. You know, very, very pharma-driven medicine. I think we're going to see a complete fundamental collapse of that, because I don't think people want it anymore. I don't think that's what they're buying anymore, right? They are done. They don't want to be. They don't want their healthcare run by this. And doctors, you know, don't get me wrong. Doctors have made paramount failures in the last several years. So we're going to see what comes out of that, because apparently not a lot of people studied in med school, because if they had, we wouldn't be going through any of these issues. So, I mean, you're seeing it is an interesting time within this field of science and medicine that you are seeing the cream of the crop just rise abruptly and quickly to the top. And those will be the doctors that are building a new system and an entire new program of medicine.
So that sounds like you're making an optimistic argument here.
Yeah. I mean, I think we have to be optimistic, right? The end of the world could be tomorrow, but at the same time, I think we have to plan for the future and do our best to. There's so many vaccine injured people out there. There's so many people that are hooked on big pharma. There's so many. Half of our country has mental illness, anxiety, depression, PTSD. Now, after this, the whole society basically has PTSD. I mean, and especially those of us that have trained for this our whole lives. This is our. You know, this is our Olympics, I guess. You know, this is our time to do everything that we possibly can do and keep fighting the fight. I mean, you know, I don't see any other way, right? You wake up every morning and you move forward, onwards, says the soul, I guess.
So people can follow you and see your work. You are active again on social media. That's how I found you. What are some other organizations that if people, let's just say if a professional is listening to this and wants to pitch in, what were some place that they can go, or just like normal citizens, like what could they be supporting to help fix either the gender issue or this other thing that we're talking about with regard to medical fascism?
Sure. First and foremost, speak out. First and foremost, be loud and speak out. You know, everybody is allowed in this country to exercise their right to free speech. You know, everybody's, I think, a little bit scared of speaking out against transgenderism or mandates or this or that. The vast majority of people are on your side. Speak out. If you know of any doctors that are standing against this, support them heavily. You know, If you can speak to your representatives. You know, I think we've fallen out of this in our society. We expect somebody else to just take care of it, and somebody else has got it. You know, that's their job. Apparently not, right? Yeah. Obviously not. Yeah. So speak to your representatives. I actually have a meeting with a congresswoman on Monday to speak about COVID and gender affirming care and so forth and so on. So reach out, you know, become part of your society, go to your school board meetings. Speak to your city council. Again, one of the biggest things is, you know, if you see somebody speaking out, go and support them, because I know a lot of them don't have enough support. Dr. Mary Talley Bowden, Dr. William Mackis, myself, you know, we have been fighting this from the very beginning, from the early days. You know, none of us have ever really asked for any money. You know, that doesn't. So I don't have anything to tell anybody about donations or anything of that nature. That's just I don't know that money is going to fix anything. Obviously, if we come together and we start building more clinics, or we start you know, creating things that require money, we can talk about that and at some other date and time. But for right now, you know, I would just say support vocally. Is one of the biggest things that anybody can do, because that's what's gotten me through. You know, I've gained, you know, thousands of followers in the past 3 years, and that support has actually meant more than anything.
So people can find you through the links below. Do you have, what's been a book that has really helped you through, or like a thinker, or like even a chapter in your holy book that's really helped you in the last few years that has been a fount of strength and wisdom for you?
I mean, the whole thing's been really amazing. I love every single piece of the Bible. And I've been reading it for my whole life. So at some points in my life more than others. But you know, I love the story of Jesus, right? You know, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, they're all a little bit different. But I think Job is probably one of my favorites. That has really helped me through this time in particular, specifically. But then just trying to understand what's going on in the world, and what we see, and I mean, it's the whole book from Genesis to Revelations, you know, every single story in it, you know, kind of just rings true to what you see, and it covers basically all the life lessons that you'll ever need to know. So it's definitely been, a significant, source of strength, in these last couple of years.
Well, Doctor, thank you very much for your time. And thanks for what you're doing with speaking out. I really enjoyed listening to you the other night, and it's been great to listen to you today.
Hey, thanks. Thanks so much. It's my pleasure. Please stay in touch.
Absolutely. Can I, off the record, ask you, how to pronounce your last name? Where is this? Is this Ukrainian? I'm sorry, or Polish? Polish. Wow. Can you do it again? Sorry. Zhivzhets. Wow, that doesn't look at all like Zhivzhets. Wow.